طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a voice out of Gaza, the beloved and distinguished voice of Haider Eid. Here is Haider Eid reporting on the one-year anniversary of Gaza's March of Return. And I'm quoting from this report. Today I participated in the great March of Return with tens of thousands of Gazans. We marched on the fence of the Gaza concentration camp marking Land Day and the one-year anniversary of the march. We had the mother of all marches sending a loud message to apartheid Israel that we have not forgotten any of our rights. In the process, we lost three young men and 316 protesters were injured, according to Gaza's Ministry of Health. For us, it is very clear that there is no hope in changing the indifference and apathy of the official international community, but we count on civil society. Israeli soldiers hiding in ditches behind the razor wire have so far killed 266 protesters and injured 30,000 more. The UN's Commission of Inquiry found that Israel's attacks on the protesters, quote, may constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity, unquote. This is why we have renewed our call for a military embargo against Israel and amplifying BDS campaigns to end Israel's impunity and hold it accountable for its crimes. The reason as to why Israel is very concerned about the Great March of Return, which began on March 30th, 2018, and has not yet ended, is that it has shuffled the cards and brought crucial questions to the fore regarding the essence of the Palestinian cause, as well as the status of the Gaza Strip. Despite the bleak reality of life in Gaza, which Israel's siege will, with international and local collusion, soon render uninhabitable, a new conscience is emerging. We have decided to peacefully mobilize to enforce international resolutions, beginning with UN Resolution 194, regarding the return of Palestinian refugees to their homes and lands. We have also reached the conclusion that the only dependable power is that of the people, especially after the failure of the Palestinian leadership to unite despite the existential threat posed by the Trump administration's so-called deal of the century, which aims to liquidate the Palestinian cause once and for all. The struggle against apartheid in South Africa and the American civil rights movement have inspired us. We also draw on a history of popular resistance in Palestine, including the 1936 strike and later uprisings in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Israel. That is why we view the Great March of Return as an act of collective mass action against Israel's settler colonialism and apartheid. Our activism in Gaza connects all forms of popular resistance. In particular, it upholds the call to boycott, divest from, and impose sanctions on Israel, BDS, inspired by the South African Liberation Movement. Indeed, the March of Return has created an unprecedented Palestinian consensus and is in line with the goals of the BDS movement. Most participants in the Great March of Return demand a complete break with the Oslo process and its vision of a Bantustan alongside a Jewish state that practices racism against its own people. This is why we tend to believe that the Great March of Return has the potential to revive the concepts of national liberation and self-determination by addressing the new facts on the ground that Israel created. These realities have rendered it impossible to establish an independent, sovereign Palestinian state on 22% of the land of historic Palestine. Therefore, the time has come for a decisive struggle for freedom, equality, and justice. After all, two-thirds of the Gaza residents are refugees whose rights to both return and reparations are guaranteed by international law. This is precisely why the Great March of Return's goals fly in the face of the two-state solution, since it is essentially in contradiction with the main demand of the marchers, that is, the return and reparation of refugees. We are hoping that the march will soon spread from the besieged Gaza Strip to the rest of the occupied Palestinian territories and Israel itself, where 1.4 million Palestinians are treated as second-class citizens. This popular initiative is an attempt to redirect efforts toward achieving legitimate rights and to interconnect the three segments of the Palestinian people: the Palestinian citizens of Israel and the Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories and the diaspora. It also proves that Gaza constitutes an integral part of the Palestinian national identity. Palestinians have played a vital role in the shaping and vigorously defending modern Palestinian nationalism, which is precisely what the march has affirmed. Finally, our struggle is for freedom, return, and equality for all segments of the Palestinian people, which we believe is the concrete embodiment of our right to self-determination. This is defined by the new collective consciousness to which the March of Return and BDS movement have largely contributed. That was a statement by Haider Eid, professor of Gaza's Al-Aqsa University. For a feature presentation this morning, we have a real treat for you, and that is the keynote address that Susan Abalawa gave at a recent conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Susan is a renowned Palestinian writer and activist and founder of the organization Playgrounds for Palestine. As a speaker and promoter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, she seems to be appearing everywhere, including here on This Week in Palestine. So here is Susan's introduction and the keynote address she gave in Washington, D.C.
When we announced that she would give this keynote address, Philip Farha, I know you're here, said his wife's reading group agreed Abalawa's book is the best they'd ever read. And he said, I really put her up there with Charles Dickens. Her debut novel, Mornings in Janine, was translated into 28 languages. Her second novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water, has likewise been translated into 26 languages. Abalawa's first poetry collection, My Voice Sought the Wind, was published by Just World Books. All those books are for sale at the Middle East Books and More booth and on our website. Her third novel will be published soon in 2019. She's the daughter of refugees from the 1967 Six-Day War, when her family's land was seized and Israel captured what remained of Palestine, including Jerusalem. She was born in Kuwait, raised between there and Jerusalem, then in the Carolinas, where she completed high school, university, and graduate school, majoring in neuroscience. She enjoyed a successful career in biomedical science before becoming a full-time writer. I first heard her poetry years ago at an ADC convention, and as a child who also grew up here and there, always searching for my own homeland, I listened to her poetry and wept. She currently lives in Pennsylvania with her daughter, their cats, and dogs. In 2001, Susan founded Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's organization dedicated to upholding the right to play for Palestinian children. To help raise funds to build more playgrounds, she has launched Ida, a private label olive oil from Palestine. You'll find her bottles and books in the Ideas Fair. Abu Hawa is often invited to international poetry or literary festivals. Audiences in every country in the world can listen to her voice, except in her own homeland. In November 2018, Israeli authorities barred her entry into Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport and prevented her from participating in a panel discussions at a literature festival in Ramallah in Jerusalem. She was detained for 32 hours, many of them spent in an Israeli jail cell, as she appealed her decision. An Israeli court upheld her deportation. Please welcome a powerful voice for Palestine.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that generous introduction. It's really great to be back at the Washington Report. This is an institution that was one of the main sources, the first sources we had for independent media, and it's an honor to be the keynote. I want in this talk to try and examine the nature of Israel in the world. I'm going to try and present a survey of Israel from multiple angles that are going to seem disparate and unrelated. They include democracy, nature, global weapons, friendship, and archaeology. Most of us in this room understand the colonial and apartheid underpinnings of Israel, which manifest in the unrelenting daily horrors and indignities for Palestinians. On the other hand, some folks see Israel as a benevolent place trying to exist with Palestinians. But I would like to look beyond this kind of contained binary framework relative only to Palestinians, because Israel is so much more. Every country in the world, of course, has good and bad elements. But I do think it's possible to pinpoint a kind of general imprint for societies, the way they exist in the world, and also, more importantly, how they impact the rest of the world. And to do this, I found that national spending data are useful. When we look at Israeli spending, we find that it is second only to Saudi Arabia, that other bastion of human rights, in spending arms spending per capita in the world, exceeding the United States military spending per capita, as well as exceeding U.S. military spending as a percent of GDP. I'm going to talk about what all of this means in real life. But first, I want to touch on the prevailing perception of Israel, which has been cultivated through sustained, multi-tiered, multi-pronged public relations campaigns that present Israel as an unfairly maligned modern democracy, one that is advanced, socially enlightened, and endlessly innovative, from such absurd claims as having invented falafel to the equally absurd claim of being less than 1 year away from curing cancer. It's actually a real thing. What is promulgated through popular international media is typically not merely an exaggeration of reality or even just spin, but it's often precisely the opposite of reality. A case in point is this article in Scientific American, a respected magazine that translates scientific information for laypersons. The article touted Israel's desalination plants as unprecedented ingenuity in the region, using language that comports with the old proposition that Israel is a miracle that made the desert bloom. The reality could not be further from that. Two implicit lies in the title and subtitle alone. First, Arab nations in the Gulf have been using desalination technology for the past 50 years. But more important is the little-known fact that Ramallah's annual rainfall actually exceeds London's annual rainfall, and Jerusalem's rainfall is nearly on par with London's, plus it's way sunnier. The point is that Palestine isn't and never was dry, desert, or barren. This is the cover of a detailed audit book of all the ways that Israel has profoundly and detrimentally altered the natural biomes, landscape, hydraulic potential, and ecological balance of Palestine. It is a monumentally depressing read, but I don't have time to go into the terrible details, but keeping with the example at hand, I'm briefly going to touch on water. The article described Israel as a, quote, galvanized civilization that created water from nothingness, where a few miles away, water disappeared and civilizations crumbled. In fact, in its first years of establishment, Israel began water diversion projects and overpumping from rivers and tributaries to serve Zionist settlements with unsustainable European standards, which were utterly in conflict with the local terrain and which set the stage for a multitude of environmental disasters all across Palestine. One example among many of Israel's destruction of Palestine's natural water systems is the Al-Auja River, which Israel renamed as the Yarkon. It was a vigorous coastal river described in an 1891 travel guide as, quote, a roaring river that zigzags until falling into the sea. Its power turns mills, and small fish can be caught in it. In a mere decade of Israeli management of Palestine's water, this life-giving river was reduced to a trickle of sewage, its water siphoned and replaced with a toxic sludge of industrial and domestic pollutants, which, in 1997, ate through the lungs and vital organs of athletes competing in the Maccabiah Games, when a bridge fell and they fell into the river. One of Israel's first water projects when it conquered the rest of Palestine was to divert as much water as possible from the Jordan River once it gained access. This spurred Syria and Jordan to follow suit to preserve their own share of regional waters. And decades later, water levels are so low that the Jordan River can no longer replenish the Dead Sea. The declining water levels, coupled with Israel's evaporation ponds to extract minerals and other industrial activities, have created an environmental disaster never before seen in Palestine. It has become cliche to say that the Dead Sea is dying. In the 1950s, Israel drained Palestine's Hula wetlands, a regional biodiversity treasure, in order to establish Jewish settlements. Hundreds of such colonial projects have greatly denigrated the rich biological and geographical diversity that once thrived in that terrain where three continents meet. Some of the fish and birds that were destroyed by this project were found nowhere else in the world and have since gone extinct. This is to say nothing of the way that the land has been scarred and disfigured, hilltops decapitated for rapacious settlements, millions of imported fast-growing trees planted to conceal destroyed Palestinian villages, only for these non-native trees to be rejected by the land in massive forest fires, leaving a scorched earth on hundreds of thousands of acres. And it is to say nothing of the systematic ways in which Israel uproots olive trees and other fruit-bearing trees that sustain Palestinian families. There are countless such examples and systematic ways in which Israel has devastated nature, sometimes in ways that cannot be undone. And although Israel's role as a destroyer of Palestinian society overshadows their environmental record, Israel should nonetheless be counted among the world's polluters, decimators of trees, and spoilers of nature. I want to turn now to Israeli innovations and exports. Because Israel leads the world in several niche death, surveillance, and suppression technologies and tactics. It is well known and admitted by Israeli weapons manufacturers that they test their weapons on Palestinians. And Gaza is their biggest laboratory. According to Daryl Lee of the University of Chicago, Gaza is a, quote, space where Israel tests and refines various techniques of management, continuously experimenting in search of an optimal balance between maximum control over territory and minimum responsibility for its non-Jewish population. I told you earlier that Israel is right there with Saudi Arabia, leading the world in military spending per capita. Other countries like the United States, Russia, and China aren't far behind. But where an extraordinary difference emerges is with military exports. Studies and international databases will show that Israel is anywhere from the fourth to the eighth largest exporter of arms, and this depends on the year and the currency examined. I should point out, however, that these data are likely gross underestimations because Israel doesn't actually report its arms deals, many of which occur through covert deals via independent arms hustlers, often retired Israeli military generals. Given that Israel is listed among exporters of arms with far bigger populations and far bigger economies, I looked for data to show exports per capita, and I came up mostly empty-handed, to my surprise. I'm sure that data must be out there somewhere, but I couldn't find it. So I put on my old scientist and statistician hat and did the calculations myself. I used two databases. The first was of the top arms exporters in U.S. dollars for years 2010 to 2018, from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, which compiles data on arms transfers and conflicts around the world. Then, using Excel functions, I matched those data up with a world population database for corresponding years from the World Bank. Then, using simple arithmetic functions, I calculated and graphed arms sales, normalized to the size of the population to determine arms export per capita for all the countries in the SIPRI database. And what I found is that Israel leads the entire world in arms exports, often by a huge margin every single year between 2010 and 2018. With the exception of 2011, in which Sweden, strangely, was neck and neck with them. Again, these data do not include the vast covert arms transfers, military training, and surveillance technology. One of Israel's biggest military hardware niches is drones. Over 60% of global drones exports come from Israel. And the United States is just in second place with just less than 24%. The attractiveness of Israeli arms is that they boast of being combat tested. A case in point is Israel's Hermes 900, which was still in the testing phase when it was used against civilians in Gaza in 2014. A mere 3 weeks after that onslaught in Gaza that murdered 2,200 people and maimed tens of thousands more, Israel held a drone trade show called Israel Unmanned Systems 2014 in which that Hermes 900 was all the rage for its so-called performance in Gaza. In that assault in 2014, Israel used drones to kill at least 840 people. In the current assault on Gaza protesters, Israel is using a series of new drones called the Cyclone Riot Control Drone System. It's being used to spray aerosol and gas substances from the sky. They appear to be used for the first time against the Great March of Return. The company that makes the Cyclone claims on their website to be a leading supplier for police in the United States, and they boast that their product claims are based on practical field experience. So what happens after these death and suppression technologies are developed and tested on the bodies, psyches, and spirits of Palestinians? Throughout its short history, Israel has been one of the most dependable suppliers of weapons to pariah regimes, especially in situations where weapons embargoes were put in place due to severe human rights abuses. The ones I'm going to show you were revealed due to leaks, revolutions, or specific investigations, especially those by two Israeli human rights activists, Itay Mack and Yair Aron. In South Sudan's civil war, Israel continued to supply the South Sudanese regime with weapons despite an ongoing civil war that had left 500,000 people dead and 4 million displaced in the past 5 years. Israel's arms sales to South Sudan continued despite a UN report that documented extensive and grave human rights violations, including the drafting of child soldiers, burning of villages, systematic rape, indiscriminate killing, pillaging, and destruction of infrastructure. And they continue to supply weapons to them despite a U.S. arms embargo, followed by a U.N. arms embargo against South Sudan. In fact, just a few months ago, the former head of the Israeli Army's operation was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department as an agent who sold over $150 million worth of weapons under the cover of an agricultural company that was supposed to be building affordable housing in South Sudan. In the Bosnian massacres, Israel sold weapons to Serbian forces during the Bosnian War in the early 90s, long after the UN embargo was declared in 91. In 92, when Slobodan Milosevic was on trial, the president of Serbia at the time, he was described at the time as the new Hitler of Europe. I think most of us in this room are old enough to remember him. At that time, Israel opened an embassy in Serbia. And simultaneously, Serbian forces were creating concentration camps and committing massacres against Bosnian Muslims that led to the murder of an estimated 250,000 people. Itay Mack, whom I mentioned earlier, gathered evidence that Israelis in the highest offices were involved in both arming and training Serbian forces. Mack and Oran then petitioned the Israeli Supreme Court with concrete evidence of this, including the diary of Ratko Mladic, who's on trial at the ICC for war crimes. They had his diary in which he cataloged all the training and weapons that were transferred to them. Israel's high court rejected the petition, arguing that declassifying documents exposing Israel's role in the Bosnian genocide would harm Israeli interests. Adding insult to injury, Israel is now engaged in revising the history of this genocide. So, Israel supplied weapons to Serbia while it was known that they were committing genocide, and while there was a UN embargo, arms embargo in place, and Israel's high court covered it all up. In Myanmar, We know that Israel continued to transfer weapons to the Burmese army long after they were accused of committing war crimes, including murder, rape, torture, and the burning of villages that left thousands dead and at least 700,000 displaced from the Rohingya minority. Israel was selling arms to Myanmar well after the European Union and the United States imposed an arms embargo on the country. Mack and Oran petitioned the Israeli High Court to stop these weapon sales, but the ruling was kept classified. But we know that Israel continued to supply armored land and water vehicles and artillery to the Burmese military. So, once again, Israel supplied arms to Myanmar while it was known that they were committing ethnic cleansing and while there was a UN embargo in place, and Israel's high court helped to cover it up and enable it. In Rwanda, going back again to the 1990s, to another horrific genocide, an estimated 1 million men, women, and children were massacred in Rwanda in the space of 100 days. It is said to be the fastest pace of genocide in human history. Israel provided the rifles, ammunition, and grenades that made it all possible. Itay Mack, again, in petitioning the Israeli High Court to declassify the arms transfers, quoted the Israeli arms dealer who, in Rwanda, said, quote, "I'm actually a doctor," unquote, expressing pride for supplying those weapons because, he said, he helped the victims die quickly. Israel's high court ruled that the details of those arms deals will remain a secret, again, claiming that it would harm Israeli interests to reveal the extent of those arms transfers. So, again, Israel supplied Rwanda with weapons while it was known that a genocide was taking place and while a UN arms embargo was in place, and Israel's high court helped to cover it up. Adding insult to injury, again, Israel later backed a move at the UN by Rwanda to rewrite history of this particular genocide as a larger quid pro quo with Paul Kagame, president of Rwanda, to take in asylum seekers deported from Israel. Now, going even further back to apartheid South Africa, this is the cover of an explosive book when it was published in 2010 by Sasha Polakowski, detailing the never-before-known extent of cooperation between Israel and the apartheid government of South Africa. Israel was South Africa's closest ally, its most important arms supplier, and eventually its only friend in a world that could no longer look the other way from the crimes of apartheid. The coordination between the two countries was unprecedented. Their respective intelligence chiefs held regular meetings sharing information and training and surveillance. They gave unfettered access to each other's military tactics, missions, and intelligence. Their relationship was actually deeper than mere trade and coordination. Israel had a spiritual and moral affinity for the apartheid government in South Africa, which was articulated in the 1980s by Israeli Chief of Staff Rafael Itan, who said, referring to blacks in South Africa, that they, quote, "want to gain control over the white minority, just like the Arabs here want to gain control over us. And we too, like the white minority in South Africa, must act to prevent them from taking over us." In 1976, just 2 months after Israel rolled out the red carpet for the South African president, schoolchildren in Soweto took to the streets to demonstrate against an imposed racist curriculum. The white South African police mowed them down with weapons that had been supplied by Israel. What shocked the world further from this book was to finally learn that Israel had offered to provide the apartheid government with nuclear arms as far back as 1975. Israel tried to prevent the declassification of the post-apartheid government documents, but they were unsuccessful, and it became clear that Israel did indeed lead to the nuclear armament of the apartheid regime, which luckily disarmed voluntarily following the fall of apartheid. One more thing that's worth noting here. In 2007, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned that his country could one day, quote, face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights. And as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished. There are so many more examples of such violent Israeli subterfuge in the world. And I'm going to quickly rattle through a few of these examples without going into detail for the sake of time. But just know that every one of these instances, and this is not a complete list, of Sub Rosa arms sales occurred to bolster repressive, brutal regimes at different times, and as well as training of mercenaries to facilitate corporate plunder. Israel continued supplying arms to the former repressive white colonial regime in Rhodesia, or modern-day Zimbabwe, after UN sanctions were imposed in 1967. Israel armed and supported Portugal against national liberation movements in the former colonies of Mozambique, Angola, and Guinea-Bissau. Israel funded and trained the military repression of anti-colonial uprisings and/or dictatorships in the Ivory Coast, Central African Republic, Benin, Togo, Cameroon, Senegal, Uganda, Nigeria, and Somalia. Israel armed all sides of the Angola civil war at different times over 40 years. They used this colonial tactic in other places to fuel and arm wars to divide and reconquer Africa. Israel armed and trained elite units in Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, bolstering the brutal rule of Mobutu Sese Seko following the assassination of Pan-Africanist Patrice Lumumba. They sold arms to Sri Lanka to suppress the Tamils. Israel provided nearly all arms sold to the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua that terrorized its people for over 12 years. Following the democratic election of the Sandinistas, Israel funneled arms to the brutal Nicaraguan Contras and was embroiled in what became known as the Iran-Contra affair. They likewise sold arms to Guatemalan death squads, as well as death squads in El Salvador and Honduras, to Chile during Pinochet's horrific dictatorship, to Rafael Trujillo during his dictatorship of the Dominican Republic, to the terrorist Argentinian junta in the 1970s. In many of these places, Israel also sold surveillance technology to monitor phones and track political activists. They did the same thing in the Philippines during the Ferdinand Marcos era and in Indonesia under the repressive Suharto. They're also now supplying weapons to the accused war criminal leader of Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. In Cameroon, Israeli generals provide training and arms to protect dictator Paul Biya, who has been crushing political dissidents, disappearing, assassinating, and torturing activists. They're doing the same thing in the oil-rich Equatorial Guinea, colluding with Obiang Nguema and ExxonMobil to suppress political dissent and facilitate the siphoning of that nation's resources to enrich its rulers and U.S. And Israeli corporations while its people languish in abject poverty. Israel also provides countries and corporations with wares and training for domestic policing and suppression of dissent. In places like Brazil, Israel plays a huge role in the domestic surveillance, prisons, militarized borders, and internal policing and suppression. In the United States, there is widespread training of U.S. police departments. The export of Israel's brutal tactics to the United States has been so alarming that Jewish Voice for Peace launched a dedicated campaign called Deadly Exchange to fight against it and bring awareness. Over 200 police and security agencies across the United States have gone on training junkets to Israel, And I think these are just the ones that are funded by one Zionist, domestic Zionist agency, where they are both brainwashed about Israel and instructed in ruthless military tactics. The impact of this cooperation between U.S. domestic police departments and the Israeli occupation military came to light after the Ferguson uprising, in which RoboCop police showed up in military gear to suppress unarmed, peaceful protesters. It turned out that the Ferguson Police Department had gone on one of these training junkets in Israel. Also of note is the incident of police shooting in 2016 in Dallas, Texas, in which Police Chief David Brown sent in a robot packed with explosives to kill the suspect. It was a kind of robot suicide bomber, if you will. It was apparently the first known time that police dispatched a robot to kill a suspect on U.S. soil rather than attempting apprehension or negotiating surrender. As it turned out, that police chief had been on a 10-day so-called anti-terrorism training in Israel. Lastly, on this point, and this is something that Ali Abu Ni'ma touched on earlier, is the recent revelation that Israeli intelligence companies have been spying on U.S. citizens, not to mention the role that these Israeli intelligence companies have had in tampering with the U.S. presidential election in 2016, as the Mueller investigation has revealed. Now I want to move on to friendships and alliances. Despite claiming to be the guardians and protectors of Jews, Israel, Israel actually has courted some of the world's most notorious anti-Semites, as long as they support Israel's occupation and by their arms. John Vorster, the apartheid South African prime minister that I mentioned earlier, was a Nazi sympathizer who was imprisoned by the British for his ties to the Grey Shirts fascist militia. In 1976, Yitzhak Rabin heaped praise on him and gave him the red carpet welcome when he visited Israel. Israel has cozied up and is supporting ultra-nationalist, ultra-right, anti-minority, racist, homophobe Bolsonaro in Brazil, who said, quote, "Refugees are the scum of the earth." He told a female colleague she was too ugly to rape. He threatened to destroy or imprison his political opponents. He spoke favorably of torture. He lamented that the Brazilian cavalry wasn't as efficient as Americans who exterminated the Indians. And he said that he'd rather see his son die in a car crash than hear he was gay. Israel has also developed ties and has been arming and training neo-Nazis in the Ukraine. Israel likewise opened its doors to anti-Semitic Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, who praised his country's World War II era leadership that presided over the mass murder of Jews. And he employed terrible age-old anti-Semitic tropes to demonize George Soros. In December, Netanyahu even met with him to negotiate the opening of a revisionist Holocaust museum in Budapest, which basically exonerates Hungary's role in Europe's Holocaust. Netanyahu signed a joint declaration with the right-wing Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki, which likewise wipes clean Poland's record in Europe's Holocaust and rewrote history to state that the Poles were actually helping Jews escape Nazis. Of course, there's this card-carrying anti-Semite that Israel loves and embraces. Netanyahu went so far as to make excuses for Hitler, claiming in 2015 that Hitler wasn't the monster we all thought he was, rather that it was a Palestinian leader, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who convinced him to actually kill European Jews. Luckily, Netanyahu crossed a line with that one, and European leaders and historians rose together to give them a foul card. The last bit I want to touch on briefly has to do with the way that Israel's rewriting of history is robbing the world of archaeological treasures and important history that belongs not only to Palestinians, but to all of humanity. Because Palestine is an extraordinarily special place. While it already has an indigenous population that formed there over millennia, Palestine holds a history that belongs to all people of monotheistic faiths. Since its inception, Israel has worked tirelessly to erase the footprints of the many civilizations, religions, and peoples who existed in that land before, during, and after Jewish presence in the land. The existence of so many churches and mosques are particular irritants to Israel, and it has worked in earnest to destroy, desecrate, or control them from the beginning of their control over the land. Immediately after the Nakba, Israel began a campaign of destroying the Palestinian villages it had just depopulated, including tearing down mosques and churches, some of which were centuries old and of great religious and historic significance, like the Sheikh Eid Mosque in Jerusalem that was built by one of Salah ad-Din's sons. In places where new Jewish inhabitants took over Palestinian towns, new Jewish places of worship have been turned non-Jewish places of worship have been turned into nightclubs, animal pens, restaurants, brothels, and the like. Other mosques were made inaccessible, declared closed military zones, leaving them derelict. When the Islamic movement once helped a group of internal refugees from the former village of Sadafund restore their mosque in 2000, it was bulldozed overnight in still unexplained circumstances. Increasingly, Jewish militias are vandalizing and burning churches and mosques without any consequence to perpetrators. In 2010, a U.S. State Department report stated that, quote, non-Jewish holy sites in Israel do not enjoy legal protection because the government does not recognize them as officially holy sites. After Jewish settlers torched a mosque in 2012, former military chief of staff admitted in a radio interview that there was no interest in catching the culprits. He said, quote, if we wanted, we could catch them. And when we want to, we will, unquote. Part and parcel of Israel's erasure of history, they have also targeted non-Jewish cemeteries. The ancient Muslim cemetery of Ma'manillah, which includes graveyards by prominent Muslim scholars, generals, and companions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was destroyed to build a museum by the California-based Wiesenthal Center. In 2008, over 100 skeletons were unearthed and tossed aside during excavations for the construction work. Throughout Palestine, in places where Israel has developed Jewish cities, Muslim and Christian cemeteries were simply dug up and built over. For example, Tel Aviv University, which was built over the Palestinian village of Sheikh Munis, desecrated a graveyard and built a dormitory over it. Lastly, I want to briefly touch on the ways that Israel has weaponized archaeology. On the pretense of digging for history, it has confiscated and demolished whole Palestinian neighborhoods. Silwan in East Jerusalem is the best known example of this, where Israel has confiscated at least 6 dunams of land belonging to one family, the Siam family, and they've evicted over 6,000 Palestinians. The purpose of the dig was never about archaeology because we know that they're planning to build a so-called Jewish national park in the area, a kind of Jewish Disneyland, as it's being referred to. We also know that the Israel Antiquities Authority has destroyed several ancient archaeological sites and antiquities as a result of this dig, including a cemetery dating back to the Abbasid Caliphate and relics dating back to the Canaanite era in the second millennium BC. It is not for love of archaeology or history. In fact, Israel routinely destroys ancient cities unearthed by archaeologists, so long as they have nothing to do with Jewish history. The first thing they did when they conquered Palestine, the rest of Palestine in 1967, was to demolish the entire Moroccan neighborhood that was over 800 years old, displacing hundreds of Palestinians. Israel has engaged in such massive destruction of antiquities consistently and systematically. Another example shown here is a recent find of a 1,200-year-old mixed village of well-off Muslims and Christians who lived together. Archaeologists got a chance to take photos and record some of the relics, but the site is set to be bulldozed for development. Again, these are all just surface surveys of hidden realities. The depredations of Israel are much more vast, deeper, and far-reaching. But my hope is that what I have presented here today will expand the view from Israel as an apartheid nation suppressing the indigenous Palestinian population to a deeper understanding of Israel as a global force of violence, plunder, paranoia, surveillance, greed, war, suppression, ecological destruction, erasure of history, the forceful transfer of wealth from the weak to the powerful, and the entrenchment of supremacist ideologies that set human hierarchies and castes. No matter how many gay pride marches they hold or how many Eurovisions they host, no matter how good their national orchestra makes you feel when they tour the world, or how Palestinian citizens are given a symbolic vote, no matter how much greenwashing, pinkwashing, or whitewashing hasbara there is in mainstream media, the way that Israel exists in the world is ultimately antithetical to life and to liberty, not just for Palestinians, but for all people who struggle against tyranny, oppression, white supremacy, and ecological destruction. The situation is dire and desperate for our families in Palestine. The grim reality of our compatriots' daily lives and the dimming of our future in our homeland is portended by Israel's push now to ban the Adhan over Jerusalem for the first time since the dawn of Islam. And Israel is moving forcefully against Al-Aqsa, perhaps the final frontier in Palestine. But I do not want to end on such a hopeless note, because despite everything, there is so much to celebrate, so much to encourage our continued struggle, and much to inspire hope. In fact, I believe that Israel's current escalation of their ongoing ethnic cleansing is in many ways a desperate, though counterproductive, response to the growing international repudiation of them, including by young Jews whose moral compass is not guided by Zionism. The conversation is changing here and around the world. Palestine is the single issue splitting leftist movements and parties globally. The Democratic Party here in the US, the Women's March, the Labor Party in the UK. Increasingly, we are not alone. Points of intersection with liberation and with liberation movements around the world are being filled with reciprocal solidarity. And more importantly, our people on the front lines have not given up, and they continue every day to fight and insist on life. And in the bigger picture afforded by historical examples, Palestine actually follows time-tested trajectories of liberation. Difficult and bloody as these paths always are, I believe that ultimately, restoration to our homeland, to liberty and dignity, is our only collective destiny. Thank you.
That was Susan Abalawa speaking at a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.